great pleasure to introduce our last speaker, the board member in Hammond, who has certainly given us a lot of feedback. I didn't initially mention this when I started the session here, but Andy Swear started with molecular dynamics, and then I think he quickly realized after working with that for a number of years that he needed to speed things up, and he then brought us to what we've just seen now here, the Brian dynamics. Its application, I think his award address here is quite appropriate, and it's entitled Adventures in Computational Chemistry.
Well, thanks, Jeff, and I want to thank the people who graciously agreed to speak here. It was, as I've mentioned to a couple of people, it was a tough decision to decide who to invite to talk, because there a number of people from the group have gone on to do wonderful things. So I ruled out the people who are already at the full professor distinguished level, like Jeff, ruled out the very junior people, because I didn't think they really had quite enough to talk about in terms of perspective and so forth. And so I was glad to have a group of mid-range people who are clearly good candidates for recruitment by Princeton and Harvard and Berkeley and places like that. So take advantage of these people before they get snapped up. What I'm going to do in this short talk, and I'll try not to blather on too long, is indulge, first of all, in three slides with a little bit of my childhood history. I've never given an award address before, so I thought I might as well go ahead and get that out of the way. And then a little bit of scientific history, and then focus in for the last main part of the talk on things related to drug discovery. I should say that I'm not going to try to cover the range of projects in the group. I'm just going to talk about things at the, for the most part, at the molecular dynamics level here, although I will mention Brownian dynamics briefly. And then all the things that are sort of at supermolecular scales, I'll be talking about tomorrow in this multi-scale symposium that the Physical Chemistry Division is doing. So I was born in 1947, and I'm not speaking about anything between 47 and 57 because it's a very sad history. My dad was working on his PhD at Purdue University when I was born. My mom's dad was on the faculty at Purdue, so everyone thought I was going to be, you know, bright, and they put me in school 2 years early, and I had huge difficulties up until about late 1950s. I managed to flunk two grades in the fourth grade when I was supposed to be learning the multiplication tables. I had the embarrassment of sitting in a Los Angeles city school. They had a big spinner up front, like something that from one of the casinos here, where it would point to two numbers, and you had to multiply them in your head and shout the result out. And I had someone from an underrepresented minority group whispering answers to me so to spare me embarrassment. And so it was very, very unpromising. What changed was Sputnik, like a lot of people in my generation. And it didn't change right away. Sputnik was one thing. There was also the International Geophysical Year. 1957 was a year with a maximum activity of sunspots and solar storms and things. Now, this didn't strike me right away. There were retardation effects at work, which the only books I read were comic books at the time. But by 1958, Disney published a famous comic book known as the Man in Space comic book, where they showed space stations orbiting the Earth and rockets going off and giant solar mirrors working. So suddenly, you know, that was catching my attention. Still, I was at high risk of imprisonment until the following year when I asked my dad, who by then had finished his PhD and was himself a professor of civil engineering, what's a parabola? I read something in this comic book about a parabolic mirror shaped like a parabola, and you can focus intense light and heat things up to high temperatures. And I, being the frame of mind, I wanted to use it for criminal purposes, of course, and, focus light and put rats in it and things like that. So my dad pulled off a volume of the encyclopedia and said, well, let's talk about a parabola, and opened it up, and there was this equation, cx squared plus, something or other, y squared equals some number. And he got out a piece of graph paper and said, you can turn this equation into a picture of a parabola. And he proceeded to plot this out, and then using that as a template and a jigsaw, he carved out some plywood and made parabolic sections, and we put some tinfoil over it, and pretty soon I was roasting flies and having the time of my life. But it was transformative because you could actually do stuff with math, and the multiplication tables that I had so much trouble learning, I just decided to learn them overnight and start going on with science after that. Mysterious holes in Cordova Street, my earliest scientific enthusiasms, like most male chemists, were enthusiasms of the pyrotechnic and explosive varieties. And I soon discovered the thermite reaction, which you can do quite easily by getting a large wad of iron wool or steel wool and wrapping it with a lot of aluminum. And you can set fire to the steel wool. Magnesium strips are very good for that. Set fire to the steel wool. The steel wool will burn, and the aluminum will melt around it and set off a thermite reaction in which the aluminum steals the oxygen from the burnt iron oxides, and you're left with a wonderful pool of molten iron in the street, which gradually burns down through the asphalt. And this was very, very unpopular with the city fathers, but nerdy years in high school, encouraged by chemistry teachers, things began to turn around a little bit. I went to Pomona College, really at the encouragement of Corwin Hatch, who was a winner of this award 9 years ago. Corwin's a delightful and amazing person. Those of you in the medicinal community know him as one of the pioneers of QSAR methods. There's the Hatch method and so forth. Yeah, I was being recruited by a number of very good schools, and he persuaded me to go to Pomona because they had a brand new science center that was going to open the next year, and I'm very glad that I did. They had one of the early IBM 360 computers that I played with. I think it was the second one off the assembly line, so I got to play with computers some, although didn't really get deeply involved in it. There was a wonderful program supported by the National Institutes of Health at that time that allowed undergraduate students to spend the summer with a paid stipend at a university of their choice or other research institute of their choice. So I worked summers at MIT and at Berkeley and in the Lipscomb group at Harvard. Woe that we have the federal government that we do now, that such things as this are just unimaginable, and we're really losing our cutting edge in science and technology. We can only hope that will change. And then, as with many people at small undergraduate liberal arts colleges, the best experience was meeting my wife and having had a very enjoyable life with her in the years since. Last of the real biographical slides, I went to Harvard as a graduate student, started in 1969 in their chemical physics program. I had decided I really liked science, I liked physical chemistry. I thought I would try to do something at the physical chemistry biology interface. I really wanted to become a spectroscopist at that time. It was the Vietnam War years. I was fortunate enough to have gotten qualified as a conscientious objector because if they tried to force me to go out and shoot peasants in the rice paddies, I would have gone to jail or fled the country first. But as it was, I was told to find a hospital to work at, and the nearest hospital on the subway line in Boston was Massachusetts General Hospital, so I went and reported to their personnel center, figured I'd be sweeping floors and cleaning bedpans for 2 years, but I in the year that I was at Harvard, I'd gotten a master's degree in physics, and they said, well, maybe we can find something more useful for you to do. So I worked in a thyroid research laboratory doing experimental work for a couple of years, and my first publication was actually in something called the Annals of Internal Medicine, which is a little peculiar. But back to Harvard after the Mass General years, I tell these stories partly because they're meant to be tonic for people who may have troubles in their life. I mentioned my difficulties as a child, and Peter and I have a woman colleague, faculty member, Patricia Jennings, who has a young son who's a bit of a difficulty, and she keeps coming to me about every 3 weeks and says, tell me again about your difficult childhood and how you survived it. So now I'm going to tell you about my difficult years as a graduate student so that you can take some heart in that. I wanted to be a spectroscopist. I was thinking about optical spectroscopy, NMR spectroscopy, other kinds. So I picked an assistant professor who did very good work in optical spectroscopy and said, please, can I join your group? And he said, oh, sure, and I started learning about theory of lasers and things like that. And after a few weeks, he came crestfallen and said he was sorry. He just found out he wasn't going to be getting tenure and I'd better find another group to work with. And still being somewhat of a slow learner, I picked another assistant professor, a specialist in NMR work, and said, please, sir, can I? Oh, sure, yeah. A few weeks later, crestfallen, I'm so sorry, I'm not going to be staying here. So I, in desperation, picked a theoretical chemist. At least he was a tenured faculty member, Martin Karplus, and I said, please, sir, can I work in your group? And he said, oh, sure. And then a few weeks later, he came and said, oh, he was sorry, I said, but sir, you have tenure. And he said, well, yeah, but I'm moving to France, and that's just too bad. I could have moved with him, but my wife was in medical school in Boston by that time. So I really had no idea what to do. I was truly desperate at this point. And we had a theoretical chemist doing a sabbatical at Harvard from MIT at that time, John Deutsch, and I crawled on my knees into his office and said, please, please, get me out of this hell. And so he kindly agreed to take me on as a graduate student, still enrolled at Harvard, but taking the bus up and down Mass Avenue once a week to talk with him. Very, very colorful character. I could go on all this next half hour telling you John Deutsch stories, but I'll refrain from that. Anyhow, I accidentally learned some statistical mechanics. So this is, again, a message for the graduate students. You may not always be able to follow a straight trajectory in the way you want, but there may be something you'll learn at every collision or deviation. I got my PhD finally. Martin Karplus came back from Harvard. The French graduate students didn't work hard enough, is what he told me. And so at last I got a chance to do some postdoctoral work working with computers. I should mention that John Deutsch refused to let graduate students work with computers. You could use them just a little bit to evaluate a function, but that was, you were supposed to do analytical work and really grow the gray cells. And so the computational chemistry was somewhat late in developing. Okay, so this is the first real computational thing that I did. I started working with Martin, and he said, well, why don't you, go look at the literature and come back and suggest a project. And there was already at the time much interest in the internal motions of protein molecules, but it was at a very primitive stage. There were experimental measurements from the Frauenfelder group and other groups that suggested that there must be motions in proteins. Good protein crystallographers knew that there were hints of motion in proteins and the temperature factors, the Bayh-Wohler factors that we've heard about. But really, there was very little done in the way of theory or computation in these things. There were only two papers I think I knew of that I could find in the literature that were theoretical studies of protein dynamics, both of which described protein as a homogeneous sphere of elastic material. One by Nobuhiro Go, and another one that was a very nice model by Pierre Dugin, who actually consulted the literature on geodynamics, frequencies of contraction, expansion of the Earth in order to relate this to possible vibrational properties of spherical proteins. Well, I opened up the first biochemistry book I found, and leafing through it, I found this picture of the lysozyme molecule with its prominent cleft. And the cleft, clearly from crystallographic structures, has to open and close a little bit in order to allow substrate molecules in and out. And so I thought, well, gee, it must bend sort of like a hinge. Let's see if we can study that. And so I was very fortunate to have Bruce Galen, who, working with Martin, had developed a molecular mechanics software package for estimating the energy of distortion of proteins. And then Peter Wallenus, who is also a graduate student, moving to postdoc and faculty status quite rapidly. And with Peter, we could develop a simple hydrodynamic model for the fluid response to the motions of the protein molecule, essentially treatment of friction. Showed in the simplest approximation, you had a substantially overdamped system when you calculated the effective parabolic-shaped energy for bending the molecule open and closed. So this molecule opens and closes by some 10 degrees or something like that. Sort of, I'd describe it to my wife, and she'd say, oh, it's like those little toy teeth that chatter open and shut. So yeah, here's the little toy teeth, rather vampiritic ones, actually. Soon, it became of interest to try to make a more detailed look at how things move around in proteins. And so this is work that, again, I did as a postdoc with Martin. And basically, there was nothing terribly technically dramatic about it. There were wonderful molecular dynamics codes that already existed. Anis Rahman, in particular, had some very nice simulation software for liquid water. And again, using Bruce's molecular mechanics software, it was basically my job to think about putting these things together, which we did, and then using my accidentally acquired statistical mechanics to suggest that maybe we ought to look at things like time correlation functions of the behavior of the resulting dynamical simulation. Brownian dynamics I kind of got into on the side. My first molecular dynamics software calculation was done in France when I was there for 2 months during a CCAM workshop. And at the CCAM workshop, I met Don Ermack, who had developed a very simple version of Brownian dynamics. But he knew that to be really accurate, he'd have to think about these hydrodynamic interactions that you've heard about. And hydrodynamic interactions were central to what I had done for my PhD thesis with John Deutsch. And so I helped Don sort of patch together a more complete theory of the Brownian dynamics. And then working with my first postdoc, Scott Northrup, and another postdoc, Stuart Allison, we developed a way to estimate rates of binding for diffusion-controlled reactions subject to protein-protein interactions or other things that has continued to be quite useful. Another early contribution as a faculty member at the University of Houston was this computational alchemy thing. This is something that I began to think about in connection with trying to use molecular dynamics as a tool for drug discovery. That is, could we take a compound which binds to an enzyme as an inhibitor and think of ways to make changes in the chemistry of the inhibitor molecule, it might lead to stronger binding. And sort of in the throes of trying to think of ways to do this, it popped into my mind that you might be able to use these alchemical type changes where you transform a hydrogen atom into a fluorine atom. In this case, you do that by methods that are well known in statistical mechanics developed by Kirkwood and others. gradually transforming the Hamiltonian for the system to calculate a free energy change. You could do this for the ligand by itself and in solvent, and also for the ligand bound to the active site in the enzyme. And by subtracting those numbers in the right way, you could calculate what the difference in free energy for binding benzamidine on the left is to trypsin, say, and the perafluorobenzamidine to trypsin, and get numbers that compared fairly well with experiment. So I'm going to switch over and really just talk about the drug discovery stuff in a little bit more detail to finish up here. The early 1980s were a very interesting time in a number of ways. I was struggling along as a young faculty member. My wife was in her neurology residency in Houston. That's really why we wound up in Houston. I knew it was going to be sort of a not a good place to start your career, but at least a possible place to start a career. But it was great for my wife to get a good training in neurology, not available at some of the other schools that I had offers from. And so we would come home at night, you know, like couples do, and what did you do at work today, Hannah? Oh, you know, I did this. What did you do? And then we'd sit down, we'd read our throwaway journals. So I'd read Physics Today, and she'd be reading something that was called Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. That's basically published by, it's now published by the Centers for Disease Control. It was published by the Massachusetts Medical Society at that time, and basically described trends in disease findings around the country. And in the early 80s, this new disease popped up that we know so much about now, AIDS. 1983, it was clear that it was a retrovirus that caused this disease. And again, the National Institutes of Health did something that was really heroic in its day. They said, let's throw everything we can at it. Let's even support theoretical chemists and computational chemists to try to fight this dreadful disease that was killing thousands and thousands of people every year. So they started a program to support drug discovery efforts, and I got involved in one of those, although I was still in Houston at the time, involved with the program in La Jolla, California. So the HIV genome and molecular biological studies made clear there were three enzymes that were essential, coded for by the RNA genome. There's the reverse transcriptase that takes the genomic RNA and reverse transcribes it to DNA. The HIV integrase integrates that virally coded DNA into the host cell genome, T cell nucleus typically. That's what really makes the infection so difficult to deal with. It's permanent for the life of that cell. And then the protease, as the normal T cell expression machinery, makes new polypeptides. It makes also pieces of new DNA that are cleaved by the protease to just the right chunks to assemble a new virus particle. Well, inhibitors for reverse transcriptase were found quite quickly because the enzymes are rather similar to ones that are involved in cancer. And so some compounds could be pulled off the shelf like AZT, screened and found to be effective reverse transcriptase inhibitors. But still, patients were viewing an HIV diagnosis as a death sentence. It might just be an extra year of life or something like that. And so a strong effort was made to try to target the protease. It was known that that was probably a relatively simple protein. And a group of UCSD faculty members actually got together and started a company called Agron Pharmaceuticals to try to crystallize the HIV protease, get the structure of the molecule, and use that as a basis for structure-based drug discovery. So they had very good X-ray crystallography from Joe Kraut's group at UCSD. They have very good medicinal chemistry, good virology. They wanted to use computation, but didn't know quite how to go about that. So I got brought in to start the computational part of Agron Pharmaceuticals. And one of my postdocs started work there as their first computational scientist. Well, to make a long story short, and I won't dwell on this, the reason that computation was thought to be useful was, among other things, that there was an appreciation even at the time that proteins are rather flexible molecules, and that flexibility might be something that is useful to understand in trying to design drugs. Here, for example, a binding site might not be obvious in the crystal structure or even in a typical structure of a protein. It might appear only transiently, and computation might help you find those sites. It's also, of course, useful in the actual evaluation of the X-ray crystallographic data and refining the structure. Computation has played many, many roles in this whole project. With the HIV protease, the flexibility is important because, as we've seen in the wonderful pictures that Heather showed us, there are these flaps that go over the top of the binding site that are critical for the binding of certainly of the normal substrates, but also some of the larger inhibitor molecules. And so Agron, due to very hard work by some very talented experimental people, crystallographers and medicinal chemists, but also with strong support from the computational side, trying to calculate affinities of binding for modified compounds and solubility properties, largely taking some natural products that they started with and retaining the binding while improving their pharmacokinetic properties, was able to come up with a compound called Virucept, or nilfenavir, which was licensed by the Food and Drug Administration around 1995. That and a few other early protease inhibitors had a dramatic effect on the survival rate for patients with HIV infections. These are just data from the United States, again from the Centers for Disease Control. But a quick look at this picture will convince you that there are literally tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people who are alive today nursing a chronic disease, taking drugs that do have side effects and that are difficult to take on a rigid schedule. But people who would not be alive without these advances. Nevertheless, the problem continues because there are, even in this civilized Western wealthy country, tens of thousands of people dying every year or two from HIV infections. These are patients typically who have developed highly drug-resistant strains, and so there's a need for further compounds to help these people. Well, bolstered by the success of taking flexibility in a kind of an approximate way into account in drug discovery, we developed this what we call a relaxed complex method. It's essentially a complement to what Heather was describing, where you have ensemble-based methods for finding pharmacophore. These are, again, ensemble-based methods to try to take the flexibility of the receptor into account, but docking whole compounds, whole candidate compounds, to the binding sites that you find from snapshots in a simulation. And there are more sophisticated things that I won't even try to talk about here that you can do in this picture. The reason for thinking about flexibility, again, is that proteins are these very flexible molecules. This is a small, relatively rigid protein that binds the immune suppressant drug FK506, so this FK binding protein binds this natural product. And the region where it binds, if you simply run a 2 nanosecond molecular dynamic simulation of the protein with the ligand removed, you see a lot of fluctuation in the width of this binding site. Here it's relatively open, here it's pinched kind of shut. And if you plot the accessible surface area for this general binding region here, you can see that it fluctuates widely between about 700 square angstrom units and maybe 1,000 square angstrom units over this very short period of time. And so the idea in the relaxed complex method is to, one way or another, generate snapshots such as these and try docking molecules from a small library to some of these snapshots and look for something that looks promising, and then go into more detailed studies of that system. Well, where this work has paid off, and I'll just sort of conclude with the last few slides, some of you may have heard about some of this work at the HIV integrase symposium at the meeting. There is this third enzyme, the HIV integrase, that there have not been any drugs available for until very, very recently. And in 1999, the first crystal structure appeared of a piece of this rather complex enzyme with a small inhibitor molecule, this Shionogi compound, bound to it. It's from a very good crystallographic group, David Davies' group at NIH. But when you look carefully at the structure, it's clearly problematic. Not any fault of the crystallographers, it's just the way the crystals grew. You have proteins that are right neighboring each other, facing with their active sites toward each other so closely that the inhibitor molecule in one complex actually contacts the inhibitor molecule in the neighboring complex. That's shown even in the diagram from Davies' paper that shows how these inhibitor molecules in neighboring complexes are so close together they form hydrogen bonds. So it's clear that when you pull the protein out of the crystal and let it breathe by itself in water, there's probably going to be some rearrangement, some reorganization in this structure. So we figured this would be a good candidate for this relaxed complex study. And so this is work that was started by Heather Carlson, who spoke earlier when she was a postdoc in the group, along with Richard Henchman, who's now a faculty member at the University of Manchester, and was picked up subsequently by Julie Seamus, a graduate student from our biomedical sciences program. What this paper describes, the JMed Chem paper, is that when you take this complex of the drug and this fraction of the protein, fragment of the protein, pull it out in solution and run molecular dynamics simulation for a length of time on it, is that you don't just have this small pocket with the drug bound, but there's a whole trench that opens up on the surface of the enzyme and essentially breathes open and shut, and there's these large scale breathing fluctuations. So that when Julie used the AutoDock software from Art Olson's group to redock this compound back to these snapshots, what she found was that there's a structure that binds right where you would expect it to in the crystallographic observed region, but there's another binding site that appears with the drug molecule essentially rotated and translated upstream, so that this ring here is now over here. An unexpected binding site appears in the protein. Well, we published this work, and Julie actually did a very nice thing where she said, gee, you know, maybe we can make super drugs by using a scaffolding unit and having a drug-like thing come off here and a drug-like thing come off here. Two wings, these butterfly compounds should have much greater affinity. They're predicted, in fact, to have much greater affinity. And so those might be promising. Well, you know, we publish these papers and you never know if anyone's going to read them. But I soon heard from Daria Hazuda at Merck. She came out and visited us at UCSD and said that this was very, very helpful to them, that they'd been sitting on data that they were really puzzled by, because they assumed that there was just one binding site, and they were working with a library of compounds that they assumed bound at this site. And they were also doing mutagenesis studies on the enzyme. And sometimes mutations around that site would knock out binding, sort of as they expected, but sometimes mutations around that site would not knock out binding. And surprisingly, sometimes mutations elsewhere would influence binding. When they found that there were actually two binding sites in the enzyme, basically the data all fell into line. The problem became quite clear. And in fact, Daria told me they actually made some butterfly type compounds and that they did bind much more strongly. But Merck's approach rapidly shifted to try to create compounds that could bind at both of these binding sites. Now, while one site might be the really important one interacting with the magnesium ions in the catalytic site, having a second strong binding site afforded the possibility of reduced likelihood of drug resistance, because if you develop a mutation here, you might still bind enough drug at the second site to have some efficacy. And in fact, that program of work has led to this first in the new class of HIV drugs, these HIV protease inhibitors, with the approval of this Isentress or raltegravir compound by the Food and Drug Administration last October. And the data that I've seen on drug resistance with this compound suggests that there probably is something to this mechanism, that there probably is a primary binding site that's a really critical one. But when you have mutations near that site, there still is some efficacy of the drug that probably results from binding at the second site. So that's heartening. The one last thing I want to close with is that one of the problems with using molecular dynamics simulations for these types of calculations is that, as has been discussed at many lectures at this meeting, molecular dynamics is intrinsically a rather slow way of exploring configuration space, because you tend to get trapped in local minima. So Donald Hamelberg, a very gifted postdoc in the group, suggested an accelerated molecular dynamics scheme in which one uses an analytically prescribed form to boost up these local minima, speeding transitions over the barriers to speed the exploration of the configuration space. There are other methods that have been described like this before, but this one's particularly attractive from a numerical analytical point of view, with continuous gradients and things of that sort. Here's the simple adjustment that's made in the potential function. I won't go into detail about it, except to say this was another in the case of publishing a paper, not knowing whether anyone's reading these things, and then being surprised when you hear about it later on. The surprise when I heard about it later on was when I got this manuscript to review from Martin Blackledge's group in Grenoble. The Blackledge group is sort of a leading group in Europe in NMR studies of motions in proteins. And they had been using the traditional Lipari-Szabo type analysis to measure the order parameters, basically how much rocking the amide planes in the backbone undergo on the picosecond to nanosecond time scale. But they're also among the pioneers of these residual dipolar coupling methods for looking at the corresponding motions on the microsecond to millisecond time scales. So what they see is rather less motion at the short time scale, especially in the core, more motion, especially in these loops, at these long time scales. And they said, gee, I wonder if there's some way we can independently look at this. And they saw our paper where we purported to be able to get to millisecond time scales effectively, losing the dynamical information but retaining rigorously the equilibrium and thermodynamic information. And so they contacted Donald Hamelberg and got the code from him and ran these simulations that I'm going to show you on the next slide completely independently. And I'm very glad I didn't know that they were doing it. I'm certainly glad I didn't do this. It would have scared me to death. Because here at the top, what you have is a comparison of the accelerated molecular dynamics predictions for these order parameters on the very long time scale, and what comes out again from the long time scale residual dipolar coupling measurements for the amide plane rocking in the backbone of this protein. And the agreement is not bad, I think, at least you can say. If you compare that with what's seen at short time scales, picosecond to nanosecond, with the Lipari-Szabo relaxation type measurements, and short time scale conventional molecular dynamics, again, you can get quite good agreement. But I've recapitulated here in this dotted line what you see at the longer time scale to emphasize that when you go from nanoseconds to milliseconds, you get a lot more motion in this system. And apparently, we're able to capture that with this accelerated molecular dynamics method. Now, to be fair, I think this accelerated molecular dynamics method will help you when you have barriers to cross to get from one relevant configuration to another. It will not help you if you're slow because you just have intrinsic diffusional space to cover. It's really something that's to help with, say, assessing the substates of a globular protein, not so much for folding a protein. Last picture, except one, is that I mentioned my dad was a sometime professor of civil engineering. His PhD advisor, Charlie Ellis, is the guy who designed the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. And so I often like to show this picture to my students when they start complaining about why there's so much math and physical chemistry courses. This is the chapter of the book that Charlie Ellis was using when he designed the main span of the Golden Gate Bridge and had to decide how much steel to put into the cables, enough not only to hold the bridge up against gravity, but when you have 100 mile an hour winds with Pacific storms coming in, there's additional wind stresses, more steel is needed. And so you can see that Ellis actually corrected some of the equations in the book and using his slide rule, designed this bridge. And using basic laws of physics, basically elasticity theory, Newton's equations of motion, built this bridge and it works. And the kind of things that I'm doing are very much in that sense, but just at a smaller scale, at the molecular to cellular scale. And lastly, I want to thank the people who actually did the work. I haven't listed everyone here, just some of those who worked more at the drug discovery type things. Nathan was continues to be an inspiration to me in how rapidly he moves into new things and does nice work. It's been a team effort. You've heard from Heather and others already. I'll just mention that one of the things that's made the group so successful to the extent that it has been and so enjoyable has been the diversity of people, ethnically, racially, but also scientifically in the group. So we have folks who have gone on to become faculty members in computer science at the University of Illinois, and people that have gone on to be biochemistry faculty members, people who've gone on into industry because they really wanted to make valuable new compounds and get them out to the public. And I'm indebted to all of these people for their tremendous activities, tremendous support, and I'm indebted to you for your having come to this program, and thank you very much. I think it's time for beer. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh,
yes. Thank you.
Electronics off you and that.
Okay, I was about to walk off with it. I'm sure that happens.